I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Welcome, everybody, to Spark My Muse. Today, my guest is Petra Carlson. She is an associate professor of systematic theology and the academic dean of theology at the Stockholm School of Theology. She is also a minister, and she was referred to me by Josef Gustafsson, also a Swedish nationalist, I guess you could say. And thank you so much, Petra, for being on my show today.
Thank you for having me.
You're my second Swede. So I used to say that Josef was my favorite Swede. Now I have to change that completely because I know things are going to change after this.
I do hope so.
He said you are the best theologian in Sweden. That is quite a compliment.
Yeah, that's too kind.
So I was wondering about the spiritual or religious background of your childhood. I know that Sweden is really considered a secular country, at least in terms compared to the United States and some other places. And maybe you could give listeners a little bit of a background of that, and also kind of the context in which you work culturally, how you see that working, whether in religious context and secular context.
Yeah, Sweden is a secular country. I think you could say that in almost every regard, although, you know, still when you say to people that you're a theologian or a minister of the church, they always want to talk about, maybe I do believe in something, and but it's quite hush hush and you don't talk about it a lot. But I actually grew up in a family up north where with a Baptist and Uniting Church background, so I was brought up in a religious Christian environment. But my parents, they had kind of left that, or at least partly, when they started studying at the universities, and they didn't want me and my brother to be held back in any sense by that kind of the Christian environment that they had experienced as not allowing them to go to the cinema or not dancing or so they were critical in a sense, but I was curious, and to me, of course, I had both the liberty to explore that environment, but also to think differently. So for me, it was just fun to read the Bible and ask questions, and So I think I was privileged in that sense of getting the best of two worlds. But at the same time, since it is a secular country and society, you always have to kind of explain why you're interested in spiritual matters, and that also makes you, of course, think a lot on how to explain and how to treat that part of yourself and so on.
Mm-hmm. And then, what is your role in ministry?
Yeah, so I left then the Uniting Church Baptist. It was a kind of a congregation where they were together for the Lutheran Church, which was at the time the Church of Sweden. Mm-hmm. It's not anymore a state church, but that was the place where the church would meet secular people and baptize their children and marry and funerals and and for me that was I think an arena both for myself. I felt that I could think more freely. I could be even more critical, if I wanted to. But it was also a place where you could, where you could doubt together and to think. And I quite early on, I decided that I wanted to be a minister. I think, I guess I just had some kind of deep sense of God always with me, although at times I've wondered what that really is. But and I wanted to live a spiritual life, I think. And I thought, if I do become a minister, I would, it will always be okay for me to talk about the big questions and death and life and the meaning of things.
And then you, so from an early age, you felt really like an inner life and an attraction to the numinous and all those things that we might term in a big bucket spiritual, that many people, you know, even in secular environments would also probably term spiritual, even if they wouldn't want to use the word. But then you were drawn into studying theology and moving toward that. So that was from just an early age that you went in that direction for further study?
Yes, and that was partly because I wanted to become a minister of the Church of Sweden, and then I had to study theology mm-hmm. at the university. Although I was thinking about studying psychology or philosophy, you know, just in a sense, anything that would allow me to explore the big questions, existential questions.
Right. They're all really connected, I guess, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I always am very intrigued to know the draw that draws people into theology, especially is interesting when the culture that surrounds you isn't necessarily all that interested, too. So as we move into some of your work, the one particular article that we're going to be talking about is about the painter Manet, Materialist Sacramentality. It would be good to maybe talk a little bit about what is sacramental before we jump into that, and also talk a little bit about who Manet was before we begin. So do you mind giving us a little bit of a primer on that?
Yeah, definitely. I think it could start by saying that after I had worked a few years as a minister, I was still interested in I was still studying philosophy in my spare time, and you know, still studying, wanted to go deeper in that sense. But I also working at in a church in a congregation, I was often surprised by the fact that this faith and this tradition that is all about salvation and liberation, you know, and it so often inhibited people and made them, you know, feel not good enough. You know, they came into church and we have these quite traditional kind of old style churches here. So, and just, you know, entering that room, they were, or many reacted by being insecure. Should I wear my hat on or not? Should I take that off? Or is this okay? And you know, and it was just the opposite of what I and many of my colleagues wanted them to feel when they came into church, you know. And it felt as if regardless of what we said and what we did, there was still something there that talked to them in a way that we did not want. And I was starting to wonder, is that necessarily so in is that what Christianity is? Is it this big God that makes people kind of not knowing if they are allowed to you know, raise their heads or not? Or is it is it kind of built into the Christian thinking and the tradition and the art and the architectures and all that, or is there a way of interpreting it differently? So then I actually decided to read two of the most critical the two philosophers that I knew that were mostly critical of Christian thinking, and the harshest critics, which were Michel Foucault and Gilles Deleuze, and through them I came into studying art more and more, because the history of art and the history of theology is connected and related, and that can actually be seen in Edouard Manet, who's a impressionist French artist, who decided quite early on that he did not want to do what they expected him to do at the art schools, namely to paint the other world or the ideal world and how things really should be when everything's perfect. But he wanted to paint life as it was and as it is.
Yeah, I will also in the show notes have pictures of the art that we're going to be speaking of a little bit more specifically, some of his artwork. One of the things you talk about in Manet's art is that the viewer is also included in his art. So the spectator of the art, as you could say, in the way he does lighting in the picture itself, it changed the way people could view art, and it wasn't so representational. And this is also, I think, I'm not sure that you mentioned this in your work, but this is also coincides with the advent of photography.
Yes, yeah.
And so when you can photograph something and get a representation of it, this, you're photographing it, there it is, and it's copied, then what is painting for? Because that's what painting had been for. And then that opens up painting to other things. And do you need to use it for the same things that you used to? And he was really experimenting and pushing what art could be, what painting could be.
Yes, yeah, and at the same time then pushing what a viewer is and what a human being is in a sense. Because if you if art before him, or I mean, there's always many that can come up with the same ideas at the same time, and but before his time, it was more about representing the world, and the artist was then more of a transcendent eye, kind of viewing the world as it was, or as he or she wanted it to be, and then representing that on the canvas. But what Manet did instead was, for instance, just as I said, to use light, like in some of his paintings, you can see that the light comes kind of from the back where you would expect the sun to be, but also from up front where you yourself are standing. And so then you can start thinking, oh, so it's me that makes this scene visible. You wouldn't be here without me, you know? And then, so I'm important, and am I creating this? So are we, like, viewers all together creating the scene? And is it visible without human beings? You know, would it all at all exist? Is there a God that sees this if we are not here? Or is it necessarily so that the light comes from us, you know? So he raises all these kinds of questions simply by the way that he paints light in his images, for example. And I think that has then these theological implications, because it's not about the kind of external viewer that sees everything, but it's about the fact that we are limited, and we live in a limited world, and we can see bits and pieces. And, you know, when I turn my head in, like I'm looking at my teacup right now, it's kind of lit up, you know, by my gaze. I can see it, but when I see that, I don't see all the other things, and I'm not larger than that. I'm always in my time and space. And
one of the paintings you refer to called Luncheon on the Grass, there's some interesting things going there on there too, for questioning the viewer and asking the viewer questions in a sense of what is viewing and what happens when we're viewing. And instead of which, if we describe Luncheon on the Grass, is kind of a picnic scene, and everybody's dressed except for one woman who is nude, but she also knows that she is. And so is she nude or is she naked? And then we are viewing her, but she knows that we are. And so then it gives you the sense of what is the role of the viewer? And it starts to become a painting about the viewer then, you know, and maybe you could go into a little bit of that.
Yes, yeah, and that makes me actually think about also this, the nudity, because her body is white, you know, because she's the only nude person there. So that's really eye-catching, I mean, apart from the fact that a naked person usually is eye-catching, but you do see her in that image. What I find interesting also from a woman's or feminist point of view is that body, as you say, she's aware of being seen, but she just sits there, And her nakedness is kind of, it's conscious, and it's similar in that sense to, I think, another famous Manet painting that I also discuss, which is Olympia, with which is a painting of a prostitute who lies. She's lying on a divan and looking really self-assured and conscious, and she's like looking steadily into your eyes when you see the painting, and she's just laying there, but she looks as if she's fully comfortable, you know, being seen. It is as if her subjectivity is also being created in that moment in some strange way. But then at the same time, it becomes a kind of a critique of the fact that that women have so often, of course, both before and after Manet, been painted or portrayed naked, and it's been done in a sense where they are more objects than subjects. I think
often. Right, without knowledge of you viewing them, and sort of objectified as beautiful, but sort of unaware of your gaze.
Yeah, exactly. And to that sense, also more vulnerable and more of a victim of your gaze than actually like actively taking part in the viewing.
Yeah, it starts to make there's sort of a dialogue going on really then between the viewer and the painting, because it becomes a lot different than taking a snapshot of people picnicking in the park or something like that, and then becomes like, well, how do I feel about this picture where the woman is staring back at me, that I have to ask myself some questions maybe of how am I reacting or responding. And I think in the time, though, it was considered pornographic.
Yes, it was, and it was a real scandal. Since it's also a kind of a variation of another older painting, which is a painting of a goddess. So it's really, it was really provocative, of course. But no, I think that you have a point there, and also relates to what you said before about photography appearing at the same time. And here Manet finds a way of showing that, well, art can also be. It can help us see our position in the world and to think about it and to rethink it, and in a way that, of course, photography can as well. But he shows like the possibilities of painting in that regard, I think.
And so, as this relates to theology and the material, how do you see those fitting in together and with the critiques of Christianity by Deleuze and Foucault?
Well, because the way that Manet shows or works, treats his paintings and deliberately shows that this is a painting, you know, this is a canvas, this is a square canvas, and the light comes from the outside, because we know it will be hanging also in a gallery, and at times also in his art, you can see the people that he represents, that they are pointing their fingers kind of towards the frame, like saying, "Yeah, I'm in a frame. You know, this is a limited space where I'm in." And so he keeps on playing with the fact that, well, representation, what we see of the world, is always limited, and we are finite, and we can't see. Even if we want to represent eternity on a canvas, we will never succeed, because it's just a square space, you know. And in a sense, that's how we live our lives as well. Because we always see, we just see this limited part of the world, you know. You are where you are right now, and I'm here in rather snowy and cold landscape. I don't know what it's like outside your window, but all of that affects us, I think. And to me, exploring these thinkers and others, but also like from spiritual, from working in the church in different sense, and I've come to see also that well, this is spiritual, you know, mm-hmm. living in this finite world, that's where you can find the mystery. And I think one good example of that, and kind of one insight I had after I had been working a few years in the church and celebrated the Eucharist quite regularly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at times there were few people coming, and at times there were many people coming. And I had, from when I started as a minister, I had this idea of what it was all about, you know, mm-hmm. what kind of a meal this was, and what it was supposed to symbolize, or what it was supposed to mean. And mm-hmm. and perhaps also I had this idea of that you should feel in a certain way mm-hmm. When you do it, and or, you know, either give or receive communion. But then I was standing in the church one day, and there were these, it was a long, long line of people to receive the Eucharist. And I just saw all of these faces. And it just there occurred to me that, well, this is the mystery. I have no idea why all of these people are here. Mm. And we don't know, you know, it's just the multiplicity of reasons, and it's the strange, you know, the smell, the way you're a bit uncomfortable at times, you cough and you drop things, and, you know, it's the humanity of it all that makes it an endless mystery, because you can never figure out what it's about, you know, and that, I think, is God's mystery. Mm-hmm. And it's here, it's because, I think it's because the world is finite that it's spiritual, you know.
Mm. What I was taught the sacramental was a physical, a tangible thing that represents something that is unseen, or an unseen truth, a mystery. And is that your, would you define sacramental in that way, or how would you define it?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, in a sense, yes. And I think it is that to many people, and in some certain sense it is. But what I've been trying to explore is seeing it also as the sacramental is the fact that matter itself is holy, you know, just the way it is, not because it points away from itself, but because it points towards itself. You know, just when you feel the chalice to your lips, or if you do it that way, I mean, that's a spiritual experience, not what you think or how you feel that you're encountering the transcendent or something like that. I think also Marilyn Robinson has a bit of that in her book. So, you know, the fact that the world as it is, and in the limited spaces that we encounter the world, mm-hmm. It can come to us as sacramental,
yeah.
Not because of what it isn't, but because of what it is.
Right. So it's not that it always points away to something else, but in that moment you experience the holy, or the veil, the thin, some people might call it a thin space or a thin place, but it's mm-hmm. also, and this kind of goes into the mystical, and where you can experience the mystical in any moment if you're paying attention to it, if you're focusing on it and things like that, where you can, I don't know, just lock eyes with somebody and suddenly it's not just that anymore. Or you can, you know, see something in creation and it's just not that thing anymore. There's something else that you feel connected to broadly. And I guess mystical experience is what some people call it, but it's kind of like what you're saying, I think, in how I've experienced those things, is that there is no division of sacred and secular. It's one.
Yes. Yeah. That made me think of this, like a pile of stones that was outside of a house where we used to live. Mm-hmm. And my daughter, she was perhaps two at the time, so she liked picking those and throwing those stones in a in a pond, you know. Mm. And I can just think of that pile of stone. I spent so much time in that, you know, close to those stones. Mm. And they've just become, it was just these encounters with matter and with, yeah, with creation, I guess, but also it doesn't, you don't even have to call it that. You can just call it stones, you know, because it's so wonderful in itself.
Yeah, very good. And maybe you can talk a little bit about, I mean, there's so many things. When I was reading just the article, let alone your book called Mysticism as Revolt, I was thinking, let's talk about Mysticism as Revolt. And then I thought, oh my goodness, that would take a lot more than one show. And so I thought, well, let's start with an article and then maybe we can get into some of the themes of that. But it's hard to pick out which points are some juicy ones that we could go into. But I was looking at the idea of heterotopia and utopia and the unplaces and non-places. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the idea, like the ideas of the death of God and after the death of God. Some of those ideas of Deleuze and Foucault that are discussed kind of back and forth and with different commentaries on them. People might not be too familiar with this concept if they haven't read some of that, but the whole idea of talking about the death of God and going beyond, there are some really juicy bits in there that I hope you could flesh out in some way, in some kind of accessible way that I don't even know how do we on-ramp to this? I'm not sure, but maybe you can cover a little bit of that.
I think one entry could be, and it kind of relates to what we said. I really don't know how right now, but something you said made me think of this in a way that, and I think it has to do with the basic idea of representation. And both of these thinkers then that I've spent so much time with, Deleuze and Foucault, they are just so angry with representation. And, you know, it's so abstract and it's so strange and it's hard to understand what it is. But I think in one sense, it's really simple. It's just the fact that you always have this idea of who you should be or mm-hmm. how a situation should be, you know, the perfect interview perhaps, you know, or the perfect lecture, the perfect home or birthday party or whatever it is, and of course the perfect self. You have this idea you live with an image of yourself that the one you should be, you know, and you're very seldom that person. You're always you're just this image, the imperfect image. And of course, that idea is it's basic Christian idea that, well, there is a heaven and then there is this world, and this world is not quite good enough. And there is Christ and then there is me, you know, there's a perfect man and then there's me. And of course, that's motivating in many ways. You would want, it makes you want to change the world and it makes you want to do better and all that. But when I read Deleuze and Foucault, what I realized was that, oh, wait, they don't think like that at all. They think that I appear right now, you know, whatever I am. And this is an interview. It's not like there's a perfect interview and then there's this interview. But it's, you know, every interview makes up together what an interview can be. And so now we're adding a new bit to the notion of interviews, you know. Oh, can an interview be like that? You hardly understand anything or whatever, you know. They keep misunderstanding each other. Oh, is that an interview? You know, do you see what I mean? Like, yeah. It's just like you kind of marvel at what is rather than seeing what isn't. And I think that's also the notion of the heterotopia rather than the utopia. The utopia, that's the perfect place. You know, there's one part of the Christmas tree, the symbolism behind the Christmas tree, you know, that's that you're you plant again the tree from the Garden of Eden in the middle of your home, and, and you hang these red balls to symbolize like the fruits, and now it's a paradise at home, and everyone is happy, and we're back in the Garden of Eden, Jesus is born and all that, you know, and oh, it should all be a one big happy family, and then we know that Christmas is always, isn't always all that, you know, and then so the utopia, that would be that idea that, oh, it just has to be perfect and has to be like it was last year or when I was a kid or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the heterotopia, that's just this room where things are a bit different, showing that, well, it could also be in a different way. You know, it doesn't have, there is no utopian way. There is no perfect way. There are these different ways, and they make up our world together, and they make it bigger and larger and more mysterious, and you know, they give you new rooms to be in and to grow in and to explore and to new parts of yourself. It's just I think so much more forgiving and in that sense full of what I can recognize as a Christian grace, I think.
Well, yeah, and I think I've heard too that utopia means no place. It's not a place at all. It's just an idea, maybe, that can't even happen. And so it's sort of you can long for something, but it doesn't. It's just something that you might be called toward, but it's not something that you could actually find anyway.
No, exactly. You will always be chasing it, and you will be running behind, and it's like, you run behind your perfect self. You will never, you will never catch up, and you won't reach utopia. So you know, why not look down instead of up? You know, towards it, and see, well, what have we created here, and what are we creating all along? And the non places then that I talk about in that book is then. The possibility to see that, well, it's the different places and the different ways to be, they are here because there are always these gaps in our knowledge and gaps in in the way that we use words and images, and our knowledge will never be complete, it will never be closed, so that there are always these kind of non-places of which are really the place for the mystery to appear right among us, you know, it's just right in front of us in our own irrationality.
Exactly. It's also, we have, you know, I have one idea of what I would think of as ideal, and I could explain it to you as best I could. And you could have a different idea in your head of what I've said. And that's a non-place. You know, there's language barrier, too, with words can only go so far to represent.
Yeah, exactly. So even if we would try to explain a utopia, it would still be two different places. Mm-hmm. And then there would be the gap between where we could, you know, still renegotiate and where the world could appear anew, in a sense, and beyond those ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about the idea of, it's a lot different here in the United States when we talk about the death of God, and people are not as familiar with, I mean, some people are who've read John Caputo and his work with Derrida, but in terms of the death of God and speaking about those things, as you wrote about it in Mysticism as Revolt, would you encounter that a little bit in talking about what we mean by the death of God and moving beyond that?
Yeah, well, I would think of it as, you know, the idea comes from, well, it comes from many different thinkers, but partly from Friedrich Nietzsche, who has appeared as this, at times, as this really aggressive and angry thinker, and he is also at times aggressive and angry, but I think that anger partly comes from a spiritual longing. He was so upset with the fact that we were creating these images of God that were just images and that were limiting us in different ways. You know, he had this idea that either it's like either you have to suppress someone or you're suppressed. You know, it's like either it's someone above you that decides everything, and then you yourself, you should be humble and insecure and not feeling good enough, or you're the one suppressing others. But he wanted to move beyond that, and to him, the Christian God, as God had been understood, was a big part of the problem. The fact that you could always say that, well, this is the truth about God, and you shouldn't do that, or you should be like this, or you should love this person and not that person, or whatever, to have this constant idea, which is really the ideal, the notion of the perfect God who knows everything, he thought that wasn't really what Jesus was preaching, and that was a kind of God. This ideal God was a God that he wanted to kill, so to say, or that he proclaimed to have died. Also, he saw the problems with that, of course, of the fact that the one truth had been criticized and problematized. But I think that the death of God, in that kind of thought tradition and to the theologians afterwards, has a lot to do with wanting to find a different way of understanding God, really.
Mm-hmm. And then the critiques that came later, you talk about radical orthodoxy and take, like, both start from that point but then go in two different directions. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Then came in the, well, partly the American thinker who was most famous or infamous when he started, I think was Thomas Altizer, was this wonderfully spiritual person, charismatic, who proclaimed the death of God and the atheist Christianity and so on. And he was part of, he came after Paul Tillich, mm-hmm. who also wanted people to see like God in the arts, for instance, rather than in strictly like limited to the church's teaching or dogmatics or so. But you could see God as the ground of being in everything. Mm-hmm. And so the death of God theologians were sort of standing in that thought tradition, mm-hmm. where you wanted to critique that. The notion of God being in a certain sense, but rather to open up for different kind of explorations of the spiritual. Whereas the radical orthodoxies, who were also came in the same period or even later, they wanted to kind of reclaim the Christian origins, but in a new way. They wanted to say that, well, we want to be Christians and we want to actually believe in this one God. And so they went back to like the early church fathers and so on. Wanted to find wisdom there.
But they're taking a postmodern view, the critique in a postmodern way and moving forward from there.
Yes, exactly. Because they wanted simply to say that, yeah, well, we know that truth is not, it's not absolute anymore, and we know that there are many competing truths in our societies, but can't we then just say that, yeah, well, this is we have chosen this truth and to stand in this Christian room, mm-hmm. And so the radical orthodoxies are a lot also about forming a Christian culture where you can live a Christian life and reading this Christian stories and kind of spending time with them and make them affect you. And in this, in their account, that's what's living a Christian life is all about. Whereas, whereas the death of God theologians, the radical theologians, John Caputo and Mark C. Taylor and and to some extent Catherine Keller and Dorothy Söller perhaps are more about leaving the strictly Christian narratives or the churches and just to go out and meet God wherever, you know.
So if I'm understanding it correctly, the radical Orthodox are sort of creating a Christian worldview that's Orthodox, that is kind of exists within a pluralist environment, but it's kind of within its own context, it coheres. But then the others, like Caputo and so forth, are sort of generalizing to more of a reality that is God is bigger than all these, I guess, bigger than the confines of just Christianity and just knowing a Christian God in a Christian context.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, with expressions like God is the question rather than the answer. Like God is what keeps us not knowing and what it's like
drawing us toward something. Or God is the God doesn't exist. He insists.
Yeah, exactly. And the darkness between the stars, or there are different expressions like that. You know, that keeps. It keeps us in the not knowing, rather than makes us assured of what we know. But what I still find differs from the Caputo and Mark C. Taylor and so thought tradition, and these even more more materialistic thinkers or material thinkers, is that there is still this drive towards a kind of towards a kind of mystery that is somewhere else, and what I find that these more material thinkers show so well is that you can just look down at your desk or whatever you're sitting or where you're at right now and probably something has appeared there that was not planned, but I look at my desk as it wasn't perhaps the way I thought it should look like, but there are different things, say, creating a kind of art in a sense, I guess, and we keep doing that. And it's so easy for us to miss everything that is created around us and within us and in our contact with others. And so if we just keep looking for for some kind of mystery in a more great sense, then.
Well, I'm curious to ask you then, how does the man Jesus and the stories of him play into your view of that? Because to me, the Gospels, if we only had the Gospels in the Bible or something, then the humanity and the material part of Jesus seems to play into some of that. It's like the ordinary, but the miraculous of the ordinary.
Yeah, definitely. I think that one, perhaps just the strongest sign of that is the simple fact that Jesus did not write. But he just acted. He was just there, and I think that once you put things into writing and make it into a kind of system, I mean that's what I do. So, then you've created this ideal world, where that you should apply on reality rather than being in the real. And it seems as if Jesus was not interested in creating that kind of theory that people could use to apply on reality. But he was just being in the real and being with others, and by doing that, showing where we should be, perhaps.
Yeah, a way of being, and it's interesting that there weren't Christians at first. There were just people of the way, just being in a certain way.
Yeah, of course, and they of course were. I mean, they were Jews wanting to find a way of living a Jewish life, and and they were not thinking that they were creating a new world religion. Of course,
Yeah, that's what people have said. You know, especially in the United States, where I think in the United States, sadly, and this is nothing to be proud of, but. Some people in the United States think that, you know, American Christianity is Christianity. And, you know, would Jesus come to your church if he was here? And I'm thinking, no, he'd go to synagogue. He's Jewish. He's not interested in that. And he was very Jewish. He was Jewish 100% the whole way through. But that there's nothing wrong with that. It's not that he would have a problem with some of it, but some of it he was culturally Jewish and he didn't celebrate Christmas, and you know, there's a lot of things that in the incarnation, the meat, the man side of him was in a place in a time and was for, when I've talked to Jewish people who study Jesus, whether they're atheists or messianic or conservative Jewish practicing Jews, they usually say he came for Jewish people as a Jewish Messiah.
Mm.
And then some stuff happened afterwards.
Yeah. And he was, and you know, you can see which rabbis he were influenced by and I think that part of that, or to me at least, when I've studied like Hebrew and the parts of that Jewish thought tradition, although that has not been my research area, but I felt that that kind of a close relationship to matter and the respect for this world, in a sense, it's really there. It's there in the language and it's there in the traditions, and so you can really see, I think, that Christianity, of course, early on met the Greek, the Hellenistic, the Platonian world of ideas and the perfect state, and so you can see those ideas are still with us today, I think, that are partly that were partly coming from the Greek tradition rather than from the Jewish tradition.
Mm. Right. Well, I was wondering, just out of curiosity, this is totally out of left field, but did you read Foucault and Deleuze in French?
No, I didn't. No, not from the beginning, no. I did when I, you know, had to, because there were things that I wondered. But I read them in English mainly, and partly Swedish as well.
Uh-huh. I was just wondering how many languages you can speak or read.
I feel most, of course, my Swedish is, of course, the language that I'm comfortable in. Mm-hmm. But then, I read some German and French and Spanish, as well.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I write in English is, of course, that Swedish is such a small language. Mm, it would be really lonely to be interested in these odd thinkers that I'm interested in, have these odd ideas, because I wouldn't have many to talk to if I was.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, we're really fortunate that you speak so well and write so well in English, because, yeah, there really are not a lot of Swedish speakers, at least in the United States, that I know of. It would be very limiting.
Yeah.
But it's also always such a surprise to me in Europe and so forth, different parts of the world, that people make a point of learning a lot of different languages, usually out of necessity. But I was just curious about the French, because I figured you probably you're probably aware of German and French, and that would add a lot of richness to how you're able to ingest those ideas, I think.
Yeah,
that's actually, I think, very valuable. Well, in terms of, I guess don't have too much more time, but I wanted to see if we could talk a little bit about mysticism as revolt, and just in terms of some of the ideas you were getting at briefly, so that people can move toward that book, as we can give them a little teaser maybe, and then I will put a link to your book in the show notes. But in relationship to what we've been talking about so far, how does mysticism as revolt pick up on some of those themes?
When I wrote that book, I wanted to try to explore that that basic idea that I've been trying to explain, that if you try to think away, to think without the kind of ideal level of the world, but you just see what is and what appears as a kind of imminent mystery, then what happens, for instance, if you read a text, then you stop looking for the text to make sense, but when it doesn't make sense, you see, oh, aha, so here happens something that, you know, challenges my idea that the world is really rational and logical and, you know, square. And so that you, instead of trying to make all the ends meet, you open up to where it doesn't, and where you're surprised, and what makes you think differently, even differently in the sense of, oh, I don't even know what that is, you know, because it's so easy to think that something differs, as in, yeah, I know what a dog should look like, and that dog only has three legs, so that's a different dog, you know, and then you always compare it with it, you're there once again comparing it with the ideal dog, and you miss out on the uniqueness of what it is that you encounter. And I wanted in that book then to read theology in that way, and to read texts in that way. And also in one of the last chapters, I write about a woman thinker. She was Swedish, but she lived for some years in France, and she wrote a lot. And she did that kind of spiritual journey already in the 1920s or so, where she also studying theology at the time, but she was not allowed to become a minister because she was a woman. But she didn't want to either, because she said that, yeah, well, if I will place myself in a position where I put on, you know, different clothing, wear a collar, and I stand a bit above the others and preach, then I can't live a truly Christian life, she said. I can't live the spiritual kind of life and be on that kind of journey that I want to be, because I will always be distanced from people, and I will not be able to meet people on that kind of level of equality, and where you can become one. And so to her, living a truly Christian life was to live a life in this world rather than a life with one foot in heaven, so to say.
Yeah. In your book, you talk about two kinds of reading of theology or of the Bible, the commentary and the critique, and it tends to be just one of those. People read in critique, in kind of judgment, or in some kind of opposition or critically. And then you talk about commentary, which is in support, in some kind of, and it's really true that we tend to kind of come into judgment or support right from the onset, but that there's actually a different way of approaching material and ideas and where you are, even just in the present moment, with a different kind of, I don't know, perspective or gaze or being in the world.
Yeah, and I think it has to do with the way you see things, and because the notions of commentary versus critique, I think they are quite telling and useful in a sense, because they also belong to our history of ideas and how we've been thinking that, earlier on, knowledge was seen as something that was just there. You could just, you just had to find it, you know, it was already there. And also in when reading a Bible text, you read it in order to find out what God really meant, you know, when it was written or when God inspired that author or so. And so you should just comment upon it in order to lay bare that kind of inner truth. And then later on, then we became critical and the human mind was, God is perhaps even just an illusion and the human mind can criticize and I can see that that is true, but that isn't. And, you know, and to some extent, I think that's kind of the enlightened thinker that we still think is like the more true and rational and so. But this comes from Foucault, the notion of the commentary versus the critique, because he says that, both are stuck in a world where you miss out on a lot of things, because the commentary way of responding to the world and reading things, and in that perspective, you expect there to be one truth outside of yourself. But in the critique point of view, you expect the truth to be inside of yourself. Mm. And you are the judge of the world, you know. Either God is the judge of things or you are the judge of things. So that's a commentary versus a critique. But you know, what if it's more than that? Or what if we don't have to abide to neither of those? But if we can see the world that appears, a lot of appearances that our minds, we can't make sense of everything. And God, whatever God is a mystery. And so God will not help us make sense of things in that way, you know. So Foucault really wants to try to show us a third way of being. And of course, it's really hard to find the words to explain it. And I've been trying to think of it as like kind of post-representational or performative or, But I still sense that he has a point there. The idea that there would be one truth somewhere outside of me, that's in a sense limiting. And the idea that I would have the answers to everything, I know that that isn't true. So I'm kind of fond of that kind of humble way of relating to the world. I think it also has to do with how we relate to the environment, that the trees are we should look differently on the trees and on the world, and the people we meet.
Well, one of the things about when we speak about truth and people say, well, the truth is out there, but we might not be able to access it, or of course there's absolute truth and I've found it and the Holy Spirit told me, then, you're up against, why isn't the Holy Spirit delivering this message the same to everyone? And everybody has these different ideas. Protestantism has been really good at doing church splits and things, the denominational splits. And you realize there's if you think about it with any kind of rationality, you realize there's some serious different interpretations of the truth based on what people are assuming is the Holy Spirit or rationality or whatever. And it comes to break down. You start to think, what can you base these things on? And of course you can base certain things on, values and principles and things like that. But in terms of understanding God or understanding the way things ought to be in some completely locked down way, it starts to get very, very difficult. And so I see your point in understanding meaning or reality or something like that. If we take it as it comes without deciding sort of which side we're on or how it has to come in a sense that it's prepackaged or something, and we're just experiencing it we're experiencing the sacred as, I want to say, it's hard to say it exactly, maybe incarnated or performative or in those sense that we're experiencing all of life as this kind of gift with God in and through it, I guess you could say, that we're at least interacting with God in a bigger way, and we're acknowledging God in those ways in sort of a humble way. Like, I probably don't get it, but I'm here for the ride and I'm engaged.
yeah, exactly. And that because that will, I think, keep you humble to the fact that there's always more to explore and there are more perspectives than the ones I've seen, you know, and so I have to be open to other people's experiences and the truths that they've encountered in their lives, and also that then when I meet someone else's conviction, then I don't have to feel threatened because it will just open more space for me or for my own thinking. There is a wonderful concept in that Deleuze uses, which is the phantasm, and phantasms to him are, for instance, those ideas that we hold true, you know, the ideas that we have that are true, or that we think are true to us. Mm-hmm. But he says that, yeah, well, they are phantasms. Of course they exist. I mean, of course those interpretations of the Holy Spirit or so exist, and they change people's lives and even, you know, world politics or whatever. Of course, I mean, notions of God have such power, and to that extent they are real. And they are real here among us, but they are phantasms, and there are other phantasms as well, you know. Mm-hmm. and they enrich the world, but they're not final, because there will always be other ideas that appear and have the same kind of force and create something different than
Right, and it's true that as certain denominations, for instance, think, well, this is how, for instance, this is the role of women, this is God ordained, and this is the way women should be in the world, this is the role. And then culture comes in very forcefully with another phantasm of equality. Mm. Suddenly the Bible seems different now. Somehow God is speaking differently about, oh, well, maybe women can have leadership. Well, maybe, you know, when 20 years ago, God apparently, and the Holy Spirit apparently wasn't saying that. But now there's a shift. What happened? And the force of culture is influencing the Holy Spirit. What's happening? You know, so we know that there's more at play than what this notion of the Holy Spirit is happening, and it's a little different than what the people are assuming. I think that the phantasm of culture might be influencing us to a greater truth or a better reality or a more equitable situation is fine if we are having more love in our environment, more equity and more justice. But it's funny to pin that on, oh, but no, this is the truth. This is the one truth, because it obviously has changed. You know, we don't have slaves in America anymore, but God, to some people in the Southern Baptist community, that was God ordained at one point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's really, it's a part of an ongoing creation also, I think, and you know, the creation is not the one utopia, but it's all the differences constantly appearing, which also means that, yeah, well, things change and God changes and the Holy Spirit changes and the way that Christianity appears changes. And it's not, I mean, of course, if I would meet one of my colleagues as ministers of the church from 100 or 200 years ago or so, they wouldn't probably consider us being part of the same religion, or I don't know, at least not all of them.
For being a female minister, you could have, you know, so many years ago be burned at the stake for that. So, you know, that's part of the legacy of the church is burning women for trying to hear from God. Are you working on anything else, or is there anything else you'd like to share before we wrap things up?
Yes, well, I have that Manet article that we started talking about mm-hmm. is part of has become a chapter of a book which has turned into a kind of theology of activism and materiality in a sense, which is coming out soon. It will be called The Mystery of Things, and it really relates to what we've been talking about here as well. But apart from that, I'm right now working on so that one's soon coming out. But I'm right now digging into some avant-garde artists and their relationship to everyday objects and how they can liberate us in a spiritual and also like social sense. Mm. So that's what I'm doing right now.
That's wonderful. Where can people find out more about you or find your work?
I think perhaps the best way to find my work is through academia. Mm-hmm. What's it called?
Academia.edu?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. And also the Davies Group Publishers is my publishing company.
Very good. Well, I'll be sure to put those things in the show notes as well as links to your work on academia.edu and the Amazon link for your book. But I hope will you come on again?
Oh, yes, I would love to. It's been wonderful talking to you.
I'll be in touch again, and I really appreciate this. Thank you so much.
Yes, me too. Thank you.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. Patreon is like patron with an E. Patreon.com/SparkMyMuse. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.